Yeah, who knows? I actually, the question I asked is, like, who would want to hire Rod Blagojevich as their attorney? Now, I guess he's got some experience that maybe some would think is useful.
He knows what it's like on the other side, yes.
He knows what it's like to sit at a defense table and be on the receiving end of an aggressive prosecution. I don't know what was, I don't know what triggered the ARDC thing. I guess it was people are starting to think about what does the world look like if Rod Blagojevich is back in it, and somebody somewhere said, well, he shouldn't have a law license. Of course, the legislature, right after Blagojevich, was prosecuted, I wasn't there. The legislature passed some law that said he can't serve in public office again. So that avenue's closed. Now he can't practice law again. I'm not sure who would hire him, but we'll see. I'm not yet convinced. I mean, maybe the president will do something here, commute his sentence or what have you. But I'm not convinced that there's any certainty to that at this moment. And the president clearly has pivoted. He heard from a lot of Illinoisans, I think.
He heard from Congressman Darren LaHood quite loudly.
Yeah, and I spoke to Darren yesterday about this, and I said, I said, did you really talk to the president, and what's going on there? And he said, I talked to the president. I talked to the chief of staff. The president, I think he called him, he said. And just like it's been reported, Darren expressed to me that he was surprised that President Trump didn't have all the details here. I mean, we lived this for a few years, and it seems like the president took a real outsider's view of, was this just some rogue FBI agent who, somehow got a highfalutin politician in trouble?
No, it was a lot more systematic and pernicious and pervasive, a pattern of political pay for play.
Totally agree.
And it was a bipartisan effort to remove him from office, and it was a bipartisan effort to pass a law that he could never hold statewide public office again. So should a president and an administration not have their ducks in a row before mentioning that sort of thing?
Well, look, who knows what goes in the minds of any public official. We all we get information from lots of sources. Seems like the president gets a lot of his information from Twitter. But the bottom line is, before he acted, it does sound like he is assembling the information that we think is relevant to this decision. Do I think he should have went about it differently? I think whether you're a president or you're a governor, you are afforded through the state and federal constitution tremendous power. Those powers come from the constitutions. And I think that, again, governors and presidents should be cautious about how they exercise them. But ultimately, it's their choice. I had the same decision or the same discussion with President or with Governor Pritzker this spring. We were talking about cannabis legalization and the desire he had to have certain former convictions expunged from the record, and we had a difference of opinion about how extensive that expungement should be. And when I spoke to the governor, I said, "Look," I said, "we have a difference of opinion." I said, "But you're the governor. You have powers under the Illinois Constitution that allow you a path forward that doesn't make you deal with people like me in the legislature." And he, what his response was, he says, "Well, I'm worried about the public backlash for some of those decisions, and I'd like the legislature behind it." Well, there you go, right? And so, but the point
is, this is why we have multiple branches
of
government,
that's right.
Though.
That's right. And so, I'm not trying to beat up Governor Pritzker, because I do think where we landed on that was a good compromise, and it was positive. I appreciated the manner in which he deliberated on that issue. My point here, Charlie, is when we elect people, whether we know it or not, when we elect governors and presidents, we give to them very strong and significant powers to do things like issue clemency and commutations And I hope, whether it's the president, the governor, that they recognize the seriousness for which some of the things they may do have in the public.
On that note, they also have the power of the bully pulpit. And in a recent large-scale shooting in El Paso, the shooter mimicked rhetoric of nativism that and anti-immigration sentiment that has been common in the Trump administration, not only by the president, but by other top officials under him. Is that a problem in your view?
Well, look, I think the political rhetoric that is hyper-existent in politics today is a problem. I recognize there are many people who want to point to the president.
He call it an invasion, though, and to have a shooter capitalize on those words as a cause to kill people. Should a president be doing that?
Well, look, a president should not call on people to incite any levels of violence, right? I mean, I agree. I'm simply saying that we are living in a political environment where there is a very high level of political rhetoric, lack of civility, and I do not believe that the responsibility for the negativity that comes from that is limited to one side or one person rather than many people who have contributed to this. Long before President Trump, I always said, I'm responsible for me. And so, you know, I think your listeners have heard from me for a long time now and probably have an understanding for the approach that I have. I cannot speak for the president any more than I can speak for the 20 people who are out there campaigning to defeat the president and using rhetoric that I find to be totally incredible. So I wish both sides would ratchet it down, but obviously they've got their own plans.
What are a couple of examples of Democratic rhetoric that you believe approaches the same level of incitement that the president is doing?
People who have are campaigning and serving in public office have called for the president to be assassinated. So, again, they've asked for violence against the president. That is unbelievable to me. And the fact that people have looked beyond that, again, is incredible to me. And now, again, I'm not coming in here looking to stir that pot. I'm simply saying that for anyone who sits and looks at the ongoing kind of political discussions around the country and says, well, this is all just Trump, I don't agree with that.
How does our nation collectively step back from this moment then?
Well, that is something that does require all of us involved to put forward perspectives that, again, bring civility to the discussion. Look, you know, I don't even want to go there. This is the nature of what happens is people say, well, what about this and what about that? And then it stirs up an emotion and incites, you know, well, you know, hey, Charlie, what about the thing that so-and-so did, which just came to my mind? I'd rather not go there. I would rather say that whether it's the president or it's the people campaigning against him or the millions of people who are all following this, office holders, all the way to people listening to the radio, we all have an obligation to tone it down, and we should. I think social media has contributed to all of this. I talked about this yesterday at the state fair. You know, it used to be the model of successful public politics was, you know, all politics is local, and what do you do locally? Well, you knock on your neighbor's door and you talk to them, and you try to convince them to go your way versus the other way. People don't want to do that today. What they want to do is they want to get on Facebook. They want to identify someone who's posted something which they disagree with, and they want to attack them, and there's this back and forth, you know. Well, when one side's attacking the other, you're not changing anyone's minds. You're just elevating the debate. It's like if I, as a Republican, stopped by at a Democratic activist's door and told them that they were wrong. That's not whatever happened in door knocking. You knew to skip the Democrat activist's door. If you saw it, you said, oh, you're a Democrat activist. We're not going to agree. Have a nice day. I'm going to the next door. All of that is removed in today's climate, and it's removed. I think social media contributes to the anonymity and the ability for one side to totally engage the other side in a manner that lacks civility and is very personal, negative, and not helpful to public discourse.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with State Senator Jason Berrickman, as we do periodically here on 89.1 and WGLT.org. A couple of pieces of legislation that you pushed for have now been signed by the governor. Among them, Senate Bill 117, which helps school districts deal with the burden of decades, 60 years worth of student records that they have to keep. What was the push for that?
You know, the folks over at Unit 5 approached me, whenever that was, a year ago or whenever, and they said, hey, we've got a real problem at the school, which is we have this incredible amount of storage dedicated to student records. There's a process under the state law that allows us to purge those records. And we're trapped because the process that's afforded under the law is one which we're having difficulty and or are unable to implement. The process was that you had to find people who had graduated from the school, you know, as much as 60 years ago, locate them, notify them that they had records at the school, and then figure out what to do with them. It was a challenging kind of, you know, political negotiation on this legislation, but we were able to get it through. And
what made that one challenging? Certainly, you can say, okay, 40 years is enough, isn't it? Or, I mean, shouldn't it be that easy?
You know, the challenge was the section of the school code that we were attempting to change raised some concerns from individuals, you know, things like these aren't the school's records, they're the students' records. It touched on some just more politically sensitive issues.
I don't care what I got in spelling in fourth grade. Why would anybody else?
But what if you did?
Okay.
My point is it was just one of those difficult ones. Sometimes they are, and that was one of them. And so you work through that, right? You present your legislation, you answer people's questions, you compromise and work on the language in a manner that's acceptable, and we're able to get it through. I saw one of the Unit 5 officials this morning, and he came over and shook my hand. He says, "Hey, thanks for helping us." That, you know, to me, Charlie, that is, that's, you know, one of the main priorities of this job is people call you and say, hey, we got a problem, we need a change in law, and you do your best to do it.
Another bill, House Bill 2489, you oversaw the Senate side of that one, which allows county tax collectors to get quarterly statements from the Secretary of State on title transfers for mobile homes. And that's supposed to assure more accurate tax collection. Why are mobile homes any different than regular homes and more susceptible to a lack of collection?
So it's the difference between, in lawyer speak, real property and personal property. So when we have a home, it's fixed to the ground, right? And it's considered real property, and there's a process in place for taxing it, for dispensing with it, selling it, and what have you. Mobile homes are different. They can be fixed to the property, but they're mobile in nature. They're more similar to a vehicle than they are to a house. There's a whole different set of rules that apply to tax collection with them. The county officials around the state have asked me for years to help them with the manner in which they administer the taxes. And so we've tried to do that. It's another example, real technical piece of law, but we're trying to get it right to make it.
So how big a problem was it? What was the impact of not of the way things were going before.
Yeah, you might have to call one of the county officials in to give you a grasp of it. It was significant enough that they the way this worked, this one, the county officials worked through their associations that represent them in Springfield collectively as a body. That association came to me and asked me to help with this legislation. I don't recall, quite frankly, Charlie, what the breadth of the problem was around the state. I just put my head down and said, okay, how do we help here? And that was another one where thankfully we were able to get it through for them.
Another bunt single that you got through the legislature was a sexual assault bill dealing with hospital rape victims, sexual assault victims seen at a hospital who might have outstanding warrants against them. What was the situation there, and how did you become aware of that?
Yeah, so again, the sexual assault, kind of the group that represents sexual assault advocacy organizations, support organizations, approached me and said, hey, we really need some help on an issue that is sensitive to those in law enforcement and elsewhere, and we think this one could appeal to you, and we'd like your help. So I dug in. What I found out is that around the state, we have these instances where a sexual assault victim, you know, it could be a rape victim or what have you, presents themselves. They show up at a hospital. Maybe they're accompanied by the sexual assault advocate who's there to support them. Go to the hospital, they're doing a testing and, you know, evaluating the condition of the victim. And the folks from law enforcement are called, of course, to fill out a police report about what has happened to this victim. When the police officer shows up and takes the name of the victim, they enter it into the computer. What was happening is that in some occasions, the police officer was getting a hit that said the victim had an outstanding warrant. And those in law enforcement have no discretion on what to do with a warrant, so they would arrest these people at the hospital.
After they've been traumatized.
After they often voluntarily reported this assault. And so, obviously, a very emotional issue to the person in that instance. What remains unknown is how many people failed to report these sexual assaults because they had, a warrant out.
And so how often were people getting arrested?
Well, enough that so that was my first question. I said, "Is this a real issue?" And they said, they produced a report for me that was pages long and gave one example after another. You know, a person over here, here's what happened. Was it tens of thousands? No, but was it were they real, and were there cases of these around the state over the last year or two? Yes.
Including in McLean County.
I saw that list and I said, I'd really like to hear from someone locally who, I said, if this is happening in Central Illinois, I said, I'd like to hear from someone. So we set up a call with someone who works over at the local YMCA, and that person shared with me, I forget, two or three very...
YWCA, right?
YWCA, yeah. Yeah. Good correction. They shared with me some very real examples of cases that they had been involved with, that this case had played out exactly like that. You know, there's a woman presented herself at one of the hospitals in town, and the victim turned into the arrestee.
So what happens now?
So, the challenge here is, look, we're not going to tell cops that if you're talking to a rape victim and find out that they've got a warrant out for a murder, that they're not supposed to exercise the warrant, right? So that this was where we really got into the nitty-gritty here. What we carved out is that there should be some discretion where there are minor violations of laws that occurred in the past. So we're talking about petty theft and things like that that occurred sometime in the past. We put a process in place. The police officer still doesn't have discretion. The police officer has to contact the state's attorney, who gets a judge to look at this, even in the middle of the night, and issue an emergency order that says that the warrant can be waived at least temporarily. that allows the assault victim an opportunity to deal with the trauma of the moment. The warrant doesn't necessarily go away, but they're not going to exercise it, and they're just going to effectively, yeah, they're going to turn a blind eye. I think it's for a few days it stays in effect. And is it perfect? No. Will we revisit it? Maybe, and say, can we tweak this better? I thought it was an important step in the right direction.
Well, it avoids piling trauma on trauma.
Exactly.
But if people know that they have a warrant out there, they're still less likely to be reporting anything that would put them in contact with law enforcement.
Yes.
That's a remaining challenge. Is there a way to address that?
Well, it becomes more challenging as you ask the question of what is the warrant for, right? And so I've used the extremes. Is it a warrant for murder, or is it a warrant for jaywalking or petty theft? I do think that there are some low-level violations for which society looks at and says, absolutely, looking at what's going on. You're in the hospital, you're an assault, you're a rape victim. The notion that we're going to have a cop put handcuffs on you and arrest you for some, junk violation that happened 10 years ago, that's a no-brainer to me. How far we go, though, is unclear. We drew a line where we did. I think we defined it as minor offenses under this new law. Again, I think this is one where we may revisit it in the future, where we see an example and say, hey, that didn't make sense.
Is there a procedural issue, though? I mean, police, this is a fairly technical piece. Cops are generally going to be arresting somebody with a warrant once they find a warrant. Are they going to know that in this specific circumstance, no, I got to call the state's attorney?
So you're right about the fact that cops don't have discretion here. A cop can't tell a judge, I'm not going to execute the order that you issued. It creates a constitutional issue. And so your question comes to one of training. Police officers are going to have to be trained on this new law. I will tell you that I did speak to some cops who told me, they said, look, I have been in situations where I have scratched my head and said, certainly there's a way around this, but then I concluded there was not. And so I don't think it's a situation where the police officer is wanting to make an arrest. I think you're going to see a lot of training being issued in police departments around the state, and they're going to look at this as, hey, I got another option here.
So you think that good officers are going to already be predisposed to look for an out, and the training is going to be
well-received.
Internalized quicker than some other training that is just like another bureaucratic rule here that I don't really care about. They're going to care about this one.
Yeah, I think it's, I hope that they do, and I think it's going to be one that sticks in their mind. Like, hey, there's a change of law. Here's the instance it deals with. If you're in this instance, no, you're going to scratch your head and say, what do I do here? And hopefully you'll remember, I've got another choice. I can call in. We can set a process in place that's supposed to be pretty efficient, pretty quick, and hopefully have an outcome different than what we've had in the past.
So you mentioned revisiting the issue. Obviously, that would require a bit of study and a bit of research. Is there going to be an impetus right away to go forward with a study, or are you going to wait for some other spark to it?
The best study is the people who are on the ground dealing with this issue. Our sexual assault kind of victims organizations, I think, are our best eyes on what's happening. I absolutely believe that, they've got my attention from this one. And I think if they, if they come back to me and they say, hey, we drew the line here, but because it's drawn so narrowly, here's a couple of examples of things that, fall outside of that. We think we should relook at that. I can speak for me. I'm going to be open-minded about how we might do that. But I really need to hear – I don't think we need a governmental study as much as we need feedback from the folks who are – they're doing great work. I can't imagine what that job is like. I'm glad to have – we build a good professional relationship through this, and I hope to be able to help them further if necessary on it.
State Senator Jason Berrickman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.